Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of consciousness and what that means, I think, to really love, a consciousness and love and meeting your partners or partner and becoming a whole human being. I mean, not that you need a partner to become a whole human being, but, you know, having others around and what everyone's looking for, soulmate, your soulmate. I mean, that's what I've been looking for. So now I'm talking to an old friend who's really going to help me with that understanding. Her new book is called Turn Your Mate Into Your Soulmate. It comes out next week at HarperCollins. I'm talking to Ariel Ford. Welcome to the program, Ariel.
Oh, thank you. It's really good to talk to you. It's been way too long.
I know. The last time I think we did an interview was in your office in California, and you did a little soulmate counseling for me because your first book was The Soulmate Secret. The one that we talked about. But you did a soulmate counseling, and I got very close to
that.
And we'll maybe do some of that on this program, but what's this? I mean, I can sort of understand turn your mate into your soulmate. Are you saying that everyone is a potential soulmate, or is there something like you and Brian, of course, that have that special chemistry? So tell me what you mean.
Okay, so this book is for people that are in a relationship who are starting to wonder, am I in the right place? You know, I thought he was my soulmate. I thought she was my soulmate, but now I'm angry, upset, disappointed, bored, thinking about leaving, or just generally unhappy. And the truth is that once you really understand what a soulmate relationship is, what love really is, and that chances are you are with your soulmate, even though you're not feeling it right this moment, you can reignite and restart your relationship into something that's extraordinary.
So it's not like I'm with someone who maybe isn't my soulmate, but I can make them my soulmate if I try. You want to...
No.
Okay.
This is not black magic. This is not about taking some stranger off the street and transforming them into your soulmate. This is about re-envisioning the one that you're with into a deeper, more loving, more blissful place.
But first I have to get to the one I'm with, you know, before I can transform. We'll work on that. But it's sort of like, though, what you're talking about, you know, when the honeymoon's over, the reality comes in, and then you see that person, and they're sort of stuff. And
Yes, okay. That's definitely a piece of it.
And so what do you do? Because a lot of people, I think I've gotten to that point at some points in relationship where, yeah, the relationship just felt old, and it was, you know, a few months.
Okay, so here's where the problem really stems from. We meet somebody, we have this hot chemistry, and really what that is a socially acceptable form of insanity. The actual brain chemistry that's going on is that our brain is firing off dopamine and oxytocin and all these feel-good hormones. And we enter into this stage that's known as the honeymoon phase of the relationship. And everything's wonderful, and you're perfect for each other, and you're blissed out. But it only lasts 6 to 18 months. And then the chemicals really die down. But it doesn't mean that they're not your soulmate, that you're not supposed to be with them. Because what happens with a lot of people is they don't really understand what love is. They think that love is a feeling. And certainly that's one component of what love is. But in order to have a sustainable, long-term, happy, committed marriage or partnership, you have to really be an emotionally mature adult and understand that love is a behavior. It's a decision. It's a choice. It's a commitment. So while there will be days when you feel the love towards your soulmate, there will be moments or days or weeks when you don't feel the love at all. And it doesn't mean that it's disappeared and it's not there. Does that make sense?
Well, let me try to integrate it. So, you are committing to the love that you know, even though it's maybe not, you know, feeling it, but you know there's a deeper part of you that is love and wants to love that person. I mean, if it's not there for moments, it's not there.
That's not true, though.
Okay, that's what I want to find out.
Because if you're expecting to feel love all the time, you're constantly going to be disappointed because you're not always going to feel it. One of the great purposes of a big soulmate relationship is to heal everything within yourself that needs healing. So when you're in a soulmate relationship, your early childhood wounds get kicked up. That's part of the purpose of the relationship, to make you more whole and more healed. And as we all know, those of us who live in the personal growth space, healing is often painful and unpleasant. It doesn't always feel good.
And it shouldn't, because it gets to those places that have been painful in our lives that we've ignored, and we need to go in there.
Exactly. And,
which is what was so good about your sister Debbie's work, was going into those places.
Right. To shine a light on the dark places.
Right. But let's back up a little bit and talk about when you say soulmate relationship. I think we have to define that, because a soulmate relationship is not just any relationship. There's something about that.
Yeah. So I define a soulmate as somebody that you can completely be yourself with, somebody that you feel emotionally and physically safe with, somebody with whom you share unconditional love, and when you look into their eyes, you have the experience of being home. Mm. And if you accept that definition, then the really good news for everybody who's listening right now is that we all have many, many soulmates. It could be our parents, our children, our siblings, our coworkers, our best friends, even our cats and our dogs. But for the purposes of this conversation, we're going to talk about romantic soulmates. Mm-hmm. And while a lot of people bought into the myth that we each only get one big love in a lifetime, that's totally not true. There are literally hundreds of thousands of potential romantic soulmates for everybody. And you could meet somebody and feel in every cell of your body, oh my God, this is really my soulmate. I feel this incredible connection with them. Mm-hmm. And it still doesn't mean that they'd be a good life partner for you. Because the essence of a successful, happy soulmate marriage is more than just that feeling of, oh, I have this big connection with them. And it's more than just the chemistry of the initial meeting. It also requires compatibility, communication, and a shared vision for the future.
But that takes time to...
Yes, yes, it does.
Okay.
It does take time, and generally, you want to spend at least a year with somebody before deciding to marry them. You want to really get to know them,
mm-hmm.
and you can't rush that process. You know, and then, you know, there's a metaphysical component to all of this. So we come into this life with sacred contracts with other people, and some of those sacred contracts are with our soulmate, where we are with them in between lives, and we decide that we're going to come together on the physical plane for a season or a reason or an entire lifetime to work out some things together. So there's lots of elements that go into both manifesting a soulmate, being able to receive the soulmate, and then the hardest part of all, carving out a life with the soulmate.
So would you say the real purpose of the soulmate is to reflect your soul's deepest evolution, what you need to complete, like they say in the Kabbalah, the tikkun? Would you say something like that?
Well, you know, I'm unfamiliar with Kabbalah, so I don't know what any of that means. But
right.
I would say that it's the purpose of a soulmate relationship is to experience the highest and the deepest levels of love and healing.
So when it gets rough, and let's say it is, can be a little, because you're confronting yourself, and lots of people, even though if they've done this work in the shadow community, it might be very intense for people to come up against their own ego stuff. Or, I mean, constantly, yeah, that can go on for a while when you're especially working through the deep, painful issues.
Well, here's the bad news, Alan. It actually never ends. It's an ongoing, lifelong process. You don't actually get to the place where you're never, ever going to have another difficult moment with your partner.
Because, so, but how do you get through? What's the
way to get through it is through love, compassion, kindness, generosity, and willingness, being vulnerable. So let me give you a few examples from my own life, okay?
Yes.
So
I have to say about you, Ariel, I mean, maybe you'll talk about it, but you and Brian, who I really like, great guy, you know, you do seem very connected, and you are a great example of what you're talking about. So, yes, please give us some examples.
All right, so when Brian and I met, on the day that we met, we had this extraordinary experience where we both knew instantly that we were meant to spend this lifetime together. And
that's beautiful.
What I didn't know at the time, because I was under the assumption, oh, he's my soulmate. He's always going to want to make me happy. He's going to know what it takes to make me happy. And we're never going to have difficult moments. And we didn't for a long time until we actually got married a year later. And then all of a sudden, stuff started happening that was shocking to me because I didn't even know what I didn't know about being in a relationship. I actually found out really quickly that I had no partnership skills. I was used to running a business. I was really good at being the boss, but I had no clue how to be a good partner. And one of the big issues we had was that Brian's the youngest child, and one of his core wounds, core needs, is to be listened to and to be heard. And I'm an oldest child, and I'm a terrible listener, and I'm mostly interested in what's in it for me, not what's in it for you. So,
it's great that you know that about yourself, Ariel.
Well, I didn't know at the time. I discovered it because I was constantly having Brian say to me, you're not listening to me. You're not paying attention to me. And I knew that he was right, but I would get defensive and say, oh, yes, you just said X, Y, and Z, because I could pair it back to him what he said. He said, yes, but you're not present. You're not paying attention. And so that would trigger his stuff of not being heard, which would trigger my stuff of always being thinking that I'm being bad and wrong, and I would get defensive. And it took us a lot of years to work through this stuff. And now that we've been married 18 years, it still occasionally comes up, only now it's a little different. There'll be sometimes where he'll catch himself saying, oh, you're not listening to me. And then he'll laugh and he'll say, oh, yeah, that's my stuff. Or he might say, I can't believe you're doing it again. You're not listening to me. And then I get triggered and we're back into the old patterns. The good news is we have skills to work through them. And I can very quickly say, you know what, you're right. I apologize. I was drifting. I was thinking about A, B, and C. I'm sorry. I'm present now. Would you mind repeating what you said?
So let's talk about these skills. I mean, you did sort of lay it out, but really, what are the skills of partnership that we need to develop even before we have a partner, because they might not be as evolved as you and Brian, and you don't have these skills, and the other person says, well, I can't live with this because there's no skill. I mean, you know how it is.
So the first thing I would say about that is a process that I call wabi-sabi love. And wabi-sabi.
I think you had a book about that, though, didn't you?
Yes, but it's a very big part of this puzzle. So wabi-sabi is an ancient Japanese aesthetic that honors all things old and worn and weathered and imperfect and impermanent, and it seeks to find beauty and perfection in imperfection. So just for a second, imagine that you have a big Ming vase, and it has a long, crooked crack down the middle of it. Mm-hmm. The Japanese would take this broken vase, they would put it on a pedestal, and they would shine a spotlight on the crack. They would actually honor the imperfection. Mm-hmm. And in wabi-sabi love, we seek to honor our own imperfections and especially those of our partner, because we've been brainwashed by the media and by society to strive for perfection. But it's not possible. It doesn't exist. So we end up, you know, frustrated and angry and disappointed because we didn't get the perfect person we thought we deserved or we thought that they were.
That's my problem, I think.
Yeah, so, well, let me teach you how to be a wabi-sabi artisan, because okay. There's ways to have fun with this. So one of the things that happened for Brian and I remember about a year into our marriage, we were having an argument. We were standing in front of each other, and I caught myself with my left hand on my left hip and my right finger wagging in his face, and I was carrying on about God knows what, and I caught myself doing it, and I stopped. And I was really embarrassed by my behavior. And I said to him, the next time this happens, and unfortunately there's going to be a next time, could you just kindly, gently, sweetly say to me, when did Sheila enter the room? Now, Sheila's my mother's name, and I love my mother. She's great. But she can be very bossy and overbearing, as can I. And right. Brian was great. He totally got it. He said, yes, and the next time I'm too patronizing, you can call me Wayne. That was his dad's name, and he was very patronizing. And very quickly, like in a wabi-sabi instant, we came up with these code names that we could use anytime we started to get into it to remind each other and to have some humor and some lightness about it. It's like, oh, that's Sheila who's causing all this trouble. Let's just lighten it up here. Let's dial it back a few notches. You know, another example of this is...
Can I just say something?
Sure.
That what I think really keeps it together with you and Brian, and what I've noticed is that underneath it all, the arguments and all the maybe differences, is there's a deep love and caring for each other that may not be there on that deep, deep level in some relationships. Hopefully it is, but a lot of times it's not. But I'm saying that's the underlying glue that makes both of you and maybe everyone else who loves their soulmate to work through it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, if you're with somebody that you don't want to spend your life with, like
right.
if you're with somebody because it's convenient, not because you ever deeply love them or they deeply love you, then you're just wasting your time. You know,
right.
you can't but make yourself love somebody.
Doesn't
but
love
what you can
them?
Do is you can make yourself stick it out through the difficult times, knowing that you once felt the love and that
right.
the love is still there. It's just a little covered up right now and needs to be dusted off.
Mm. Okay, tell me the other wabi-sabi experience.
Yeah, so I had this woman in one of my workshops, and I sort of challenged them. I said, somebody tell me the thing that your partner does that really drives you crazy, that makes you so nuts, sometimes you even think about leaving them. And this woman, Stephanie, stood up, and she said, I've been married to Garth for 16 years, and he works out of state 2 weeks of every month. And when he's gone for 2 weeks, I feel like it's really my house because I'm a clean freak. I'm a neatnik. And when he's not around, everything's clean and pristine and in its place, and I'm just so happy. And then he comes home, and within an hour, the place is chaos and it's a wreck and there's wet towels on the floor. And no matter how much I've tried to talk to him about this and yelled and bitched and screamed and moaned for 16 years, it never changes, and I don't know that I can take it anymore. And I said to her, hey, Stephanie, do you have a dog? She said, yes. I said, does your dog shed? Yeah, my dog sheds. What do you do when your dog sheds? I get out the vacuum cleaner. Oh, okay. Stephanie, do you love your dog? And she got really quiet. And then she said, oh, my God. Garth sheds.
That was very smart of you to observe that.
And yes, and in that moment, she saw that just like the dog can't help that he sheds, it's his nature, Garth can't change. He is a slob. That's his nature. And it just, everything changed for her in that moment. Did Garth change? No, Garth didn't change at all. Stephanie shifted in perception. She went what I called from annoyed to enjoyed. And when I was writing this book and I wanted to put the story in it, I called her. I hadn't seen her in a year. And I said, I'm just checking up on you. I want to know how things are going with Garth. And she said, we've never been happier. In fact, ever since I let go of my need for him to not be a slob, we've been blissed out. In fact, he quit his job, and he's not traveling anymore, and he's starting a home-based business.
Wow. So she'll have a lot of cleaning up to do. But
but you know what? It's not that important anymore, because what happens, Alan, is we're all raised differently, you know, and we come into a partnership with these sort of rigid ideas of how things should be and how people should be and expectations of how it's going to go. And then we, when we get disappointed, we live like somebody's out to get us. We become victims. We live like they woke up this morning thinking, oh, I wonder how I could make Alan crazy today. Mm-hmm. What could I
that
do to
like
really annoy
mother. Him? No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
But the truth is we all wake up the same way every day. We wake up really, truly wanting to be loved for who we are, wanting to be accepted, warts and all, for who we are. But that's not the way we live. We live in this ungodly judgment and criticism and blaming and shaming of the other, when in fact, they're just like us. They just had different programming.
Right, different strategies to meet needs that were never met, as Mark wrote. So, I think you really helped me there, because then if you can let go of how you want that person to be, because if you think they should be that way because it's better for you, and you can accept them for who they are as themselves, then there's more space there. There's more.
Right, and the thing is, they're doing the same with you. Because trust me, you're doing things that annoy them as well. I'll give you another example. When Brian and I first moved in together, we'd have this thing that would happen in the kitchen every day, which would be, he'd say to me, why do you leave your teacup in the sink? Why don't you just put it in the dishwasher? Yes. And I'd say to him, it's one teacup. It'll get there eventually. And it got to the And then the other thing he would say is, how come there's always crumbs around the toaster? And I'd look at him and say, crumbs? There's crumbs? I don't see any crumbs. Well, this went on like every day for 6 months. And it got to the point where every time I saw him walking towards the kitchen, I'd start to think, oh, no, what did I do now?
Right.
And then one day the funniest thing happened. He walked in the kitchen with this crazy smile on his face. And he said, I got up in the middle of the night to get a glass of water. And I saw your teacup in the sink, and I saw your crumbs around the toaster, and my heart filled with love for you. Looking at him going, huh? What? And he goes, I realized that you have a blind spot when it comes to teacups in the sink and crumbs around the toaster. And since I'm the one who's bothered by it, I'm going to devote the rest of my life to cleaning up after you.
That's nice. Does he have a sister? I need that.
No, he doesn't have a sister. But that's what personal responsibility is about. I wasn't having a problem with the teacup and the crumbs. He was.
But did that change you at all?
It made me love him even so much more that I could just be my naturally messy self and not be judged or blamed or shamed or criticized for it. It's just how I am. Now, does he do stuff that makes me crazy? Absolutely. Brian loves to have the TV on. If he walks into any room, the TV goes on, and it goes on loud, and it goes on a cable news station.
Right.
And I'm a highly sensitive person. I'm an HSP. I cannot tolerate bright lights or loud noises.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always be asking him, can you turn it down a little bit? When you leave a room, could you turn the TV off? You know, and then one day, I came home from somewhere, I walked in the house, every light was on, and all four TVs were going on super loud, and Brian wasn't even home. Mm-hmm. He wasn't even there. And I just thought to myself, what is the wabi-sabi solution to this? I can't stand the noise. I can't stand the lights. And then I saw the remote control. And I thought, that's it. All I have to do is pick up the remote and walk around the house, turning down the volume, or if he's not in the room, turning off the TV, closing the lights. And that was the solution for it, because he's not going to change. So whenever, if we happen to be watching TV together, every time he leaves the room, I get the remote and I turn the volume down.
And
most of the time he doesn't notice.
You don't resent that. That's not anything you resent, because...
Well, I used to until I figured out that I could do something about it. Because I was, you know, it's like people who, you have two people in a couple. One likes the room hot, one likes it cold,
mm-hmm.
right? One right. person's shivering, the other one's sweating. You know, you have to have creative solutions for these things. You know,
so,
and maybe the cold person has an electric blanket on their side of the bed. You know, for me, I'm sneaky. I just take the remote control when he's not looking and I turn the volume down.
Wait, so do you like, would you advise people to look at their partner and say, what part of them just isn't going to change? That's just how they are. Just that's just their crack in the vase. And
yes.
accept
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, yes. Because, and chances are, if you've been complaining about the same thing over and over again, it probably won't change. Now, let me give you an example where you can have an impact, you know,
okay.
because on certain things you can and certain things you can't. So, I end up teaching a lot of women, and one of the most common complaints I hear from women about their husbands is how annoyed they are that they don't remember to take out the trash.
Mm.
You know,
right.
it's like every Sunday night they know the trash has to go out because it's getting picked up Monday morning, and they're tired of nagging them and reminding them, like, why can't he just remember to take out the trash? So here's the dialogue to make sure that you never have this problem again. Now, you may not relate to this because you're
a guy,
but
the
women who
are
listening will get this.
Right. Okay.
So the next time he takes out the trash, whether or not you had to prompt him, when he walks back in the house, I want you to go over to him, give him a really sexy hug, and then whisper in his ear, "You're my superhero. Thank you so much for taking out the stinky, smelly trash. Because you did that, I now feel like a queen. I don't have to get my hands around that dirty, messy trash. You are my hero. And by the way, I know I haven't said this a lot lately, but I am so proud to be your wife. I saw you helping little Johnny with his homework yesterday. You're an amazing dad, and I love you to pieces."
Well, just saying that,
I promise you, he'll never forget to take out the trash again.
That would make me want to take out the trash.
Exactly.
To get that.
And
yes.
Here's the difference. Because when you're yelling at somebody or using a nasty tone of voice or being annoyed with them, saying, "Oh, I can't believe you. You never remember to take out the trash." What they're hearing in their head is being scolded by their mother, and they're never going to do anything.
Exactly, exactly. So you tell the women to be, I mean, what's the psychology behind? I mean, I know
because
it feels
here's
good.
The thing, here's the thing that women don't know about men. The two
yes.
biggest secrets most women don't know about men. Number one, there's something that men need and want more than sex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's respect. Respect and admiration.
And honor, yes, that is true. And it's not an ego thing. We just need that to do...
Exactly, to feel worthy.
To
because
be a
they warrior
win. In the world, yes.
Guys want to win. And the
yes.
other thing that they really, really... You need to know this, ladies, about men. They can't be happy unless you're happy. So
yes.
if you're miserable and you're always complaining and you're the glass is half empty and you're complaining about your body and how good you don't look, he's losing because
mm-hmm.
he doesn't know how to make you happy. So you have to be responsible for your own happiness, and then anything else that's going right with him is just going to add to your happiness quotient. But if you're miserable, he's miserable.
Well, that's the thing. And a lot of women, but some... don't know how to be happy with themselves, and the men don't know how to make them happy. Exactly. But they don't know, you know, how to be happy. I mean, what do you say to somebody who doesn't know how to be happy with themselves?
Well, you know, this is why God invented coaches and therapists and personal growth workshops, because there's a million books on how to be happy. The science has been done. It's a learnable skill, becoming happy. It's just like love is a choice and a decision. Happiness can be a choice and a decision. One caveat here, though, if you're clinically depressed, you know, then yes, you need to be seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist. You may or may not need some drugs to help you balance out your brain chemistry. I suffered from severe depression in my 20s. I was suicidal. I was put on tricyclic antidepressants. And then I finally got to a point in my life where I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I decided that I was going to do whatever it took to learn how to be happy. And I committed like 3 years to that. And that involved going to talk therapy and taking workshops and studying happy people. And then also, this was the most important thing for me, Alan, because what I didn't know about myself back then was that I was hypoglycemic. And so my mood swings were from my blood sugar levels. And once I started eating healthier and eating on a regular basis and taking supplements, that got rid of a lot of my depression. And then I just started choosing to be happy. I started choosing to smile even when I didn't feel like smiling. You know,
right,
I
and that changed your body chemistry. That changes your body chemistry because there's a chemistry to smiling that affects us.
Yes. Yeah, so you need, you know, if you're miserable, then before you go looking for a soulmate, you know, first learn how to make yourself happy.
Well, that's a really good point. Also, in your notes here, I'm looking, it says, what's the biggest secret about marriage that causes so much pain?
Oh, that's a good one. So one of the world's leading marriage researchers is Dr. John Gottman at the University of Washington. And what he's discovered is that every couple, not just some couples, but every couple has a minimum of 9 irreconcilable differences.
Really? That's good to hear. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, no, that's normal. These are things on which you are never going to agree.
Wow.
So how do you survive that? Well, you survive that first and foremost by choosing to love and respect the differences in each other, learning how to be vulnerable and tell the truth about your feelings about these differences, and then being creative and coming up with creative solutions. So I'll give you just a really easy example, because this is true for almost every couple. There's always a spender and a saver.
Really? In every
almost
relationship?
Almost every time, because one of the number one cause for divorce is money.
Really?
So people have different points of view. And Brian and I had this in the beginning, too, because I grew up in a really lower income household where every single day my parents were fighting over money, and I had tremendous poverty consciousness, and my greatest fear was being a bag lady. I mean, that's what really drove my success in business. I was so afraid of being homeless that I worked super, super hard to make money, and then I hoarded my money, and I kept my money because I didn't ever want to be homeless. And I marry a guy from a very rich family who was always successful his whole life. He grew up with money, then he made a lot of money and had no qualms spending lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, we're married, and my money and his money are now in the same pool, and I'm watching how he's, in my mind, carelessly spending money that I would never spend, and I'm critical of him, and I don't even know why. I'm just like shocked and appalled at how effortlessly he's spending money. And
you can change that, right? Because you can let go of the old mentality.
Well, it was a very long process. So first, I had to understand my own poverty consciousness, because at that point, it wasn't all that conscious. I wasn't like saying, I'm going to work hard so I won't be homeless. I had to get underneath my own feelings. right. about where's this coming from, because it wasn't coming from reality. If you looked at our bank statements, it wasn't like we were going to be out on the street, you know, but I had these fears, so I had to confront those. And then, you know, and then I had to share about that. I had to explain to him, listen, I grew up with a grandmother who survived the Depression, who beat it into me that you had to save every penny. I grew up listening to parents who argued constantly about money. And this is what my fear is. And then, of course, as we got to know each other better, I got to see that even though he was easily spending money, he was very financially responsible and trustable with money. And so now, all these years later, we've gotten to where we're very much alike with money. He now shops sales. He had never shopped a sale in his life when I met him. You know, I'm a little bit more comfortable buying designer clothes. I'd never owned anything that was designer in my life when we had met. And we worked it out because we put our attention on it.
So that was an irreconcilable difference that you were able to reconcile, actually.
Yeah.
But there's reconcilable differences that people can't reconcile in some marriages, right?
Well, you know, that's why you want to spend a year getting to know somebody before you marry them. I mean, if you decide, you know, if you're with a woman who decides, I definitely want to have three children, and you never have that conversation, and you get married, and you were like, I never want to be a father, that's something that's not fixable.
Right.
But for the most part, there are ways to be really creative and learn to agree to disagree and love and respect each other in spite and maybe even because of the differences.
But not if there's real value. I mean, I guess you have to work this out, but real, you know, somebody who likes to carry a gun or some real core value issue. Somebody's a Republican, someone's a Democrat. I mean, there are irreconcilable differences that could mean these two people just don't want to be.
That's totally possible. Right. Here's why you want to work hard at this. Mm-hmm. So everybody knows that 50% of first marriages end in divorce. That's just a common fact, the truth. What most people don't know is that 64% of second marriages and 73% of third marriages end in divorce. So if you just wake up one day and decide, I'm not feeling the love anymore, I'm bored, or I don't like this about them, I'm just going to leave and go find someone else, I would caution you against that. I would say anybody that doesn't give 6 months to trying to save a relationship is really throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because chances are the love is still there, and it can be reignited and things can be turned around. But it requires a little energy and attention and intention and just baby steps. And it's not that hard. I have 16 exercises in Turn Your Mate into Your Soulmate that are really simple, fun, and easy to do that can shift a relationship.
Well, like what? Give us a few.
Okay. Well, the very first one I would recommend somebody do is if I'll make up a story here. So let's say, you know, I'm a woman who's been married 20 years. You know, my husband's a nice enough guy, but the kids are out of the house. I'm bored. You know, he's got these annoying habits. It's just not that interesting anymore. Everything's predictable.
Right. Sounds like a lot of people we know.
Right. I'm resigned. Maybe it's time to move on.
Yes.
I would say first get yourself into a neutral place. So whether you meditate or you do some yoga or take a bath, try and get yourself into a really neutral place. And then sit down and write your partner a letter. Mm. But go dig deep into your memory. You know, like, dear Alan, I remember the day we met. I saw you sitting at Starbucks drinking some enormous thing, reading, you know, Pride and Prejudice, and I thought, what an interesting man to be caught in public reading Pride and Prejudice. And then I saw how sweetly you helped that woman with her hysterical child. And I thought, that's a guy I got to meet. Mm. And then we started dating. And you came to visit my dad, who can't walk too well, and you helped him down the stairs, and you were so patient with him. And I saw what a generous, loving, kind guy you are. And even though things may have been difficult for us the last few months or few years, our marriage is worth saving. I want to fight for it because I really do love you. And whatever it is you need to say, and write that letter and put it inside a beautiful card and then leave it somewhere for them to find as an opener for a conversation. Like, what could we do together to, you know, reignite our relationship?
Well, that's one thing, but what else can people really do? Because it does get habitual. I mean, even after a few years with people, you know, the sex gets habitual, the eating, the day-to-day. How do you bring it?
And you have to make choices to make it new and fresh and have date nights. You have to pay attention to it. You know, you just can't open a restaurant and then things are going good for a couple of years and then you sit back at home and hope it's still making money, right? You can't take your eye off the ball, but that's what people do. You know, here's another...
They get lazy. But anyway, yes, what were you going to say?
Yeah, you know, what's important to know is that we make choices about how our life goes. And if we're not happy with our relationship, it's probably because we haven't been paying attention or we haven't been taking responsibility for it in some way, or we're disappointed that our expectations weren't met. You know, but underneath all of there is somebody that you once felt this deep, passionate love for. So one thing that a couple can do together to get that spark back is to go and do an activity that they both perceive as potentially life-threatening. So maybe that's skydiving or bungee jumping or going on a roller coaster or zip line.
So you say do that together.
Because that shared experience, the shared adrenaline rush, will trigger the part of both of your brains that has the chemicals where you fell in love. It will reignite passion.
Oh, that's very smart of you to recommend that. I think that's...
Yeah, so there's lots of things that you can do, but you have to be willing to do it, you know, because... The thing that I've noticed about a lot of people, particularly people in our space, in the new age self-help personal growth space.
Right.
And people are going to probably stop listening to me right now when I say this, but what's true about a lot of these people, they're addicted to suffering. That's their story.
I agree. They're addicted to looking for the next guru, the next teacher, the next workshop.
And and you know what? Nobody's got the power outside of you. It's just like we all know how to eat healthy, but a lot of us don't. You know, we already know that too much sugar isn't good for you, but how much do we eat? It's like that in life as well. You know, but we get lazy or we get so disappointed we get to resignation.
Right.
But the truth is, if you're committed to your own happiness, then be equally committed to the happiness of your partner. And for those out there who are thinking, why do I have to do all the work? It's because you're the one who's saner in this moment. You're the one who's willing to put a sword in the ground to fight for the relationship. And trust me, if you take a few small baby steps, if you write that little letter we just talked about, that will open a very big door that will start some conversations.
No, this is all really, really great, and I think it probably will help people listening. There's another part in your notes you say, you believe that you must learn to be personally responsible for your own happiness in life, and especially in relationship. That seems a bit counterintuitive. Why do you say that, counterintuitive?
Because nobody else can really make us happy.
Right.
You know, they can add a little joy to our lives, but happiness... You know, it's an old saying, but it's true, and it's an inside job. I'll tell you this great story about Barack and Michelle Obama. So whether you like the Obamas or not,
I do like them.
So this is a true story. What most people don't know about the Obamas is 13 years ago, they almost got divorced. Michelle was complaining to her mother that she didn't think that marriage was going to work. Barack was complaining to his grandmother that Michelle nagged him all the time. He didn't think it was going to work. they were drowning in debt from their Ivy League law school, you know, expenses. She had this big corporate job plus two little girls at home. He was just starting his political career. He was hardly home, and they were miserable. Well, one morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, Michelle wakes up early, and she's thinking that all she really wants to do is go to the gym and work out. She hadn't worked out in months, and she was feeling overweight and, you know, exhausted and unloved, unheard, unseen, disappointed. And while she was debating whether or not she should get out of bed and go to the gym, she started to feel guilty, thinking, oh, but the girls are going to be up really soon, and they're going to have breakfast. And as Barack is snoring next to her, she thinks, hell, he went to Harvard. He'll figure out how to feed them. And she goes to the gym.
Right.
And while she's on the Stairmaster, thinking about her life and how unhappy she is, she has this wabi-sabi moment. She has this epiphany where she realizes that she has been waiting for Barack to make her happy. And she decides in that moment that she's going to figure out what it's going to take to make her happy. And she gets off the machine and she goes home. And when she gets there, Barack's at the kitchen table with the two little girls. They're eating cereal. He's figured it out. And she makes this announcement. And she says to him, there are some new rules in the Obama family household. Rule number one, I'm going to take my mother up on her offer to help me out with the girls, to do some of the driving, to do the grocery shopping for me. Barack, from now on, every night that you're in town, we're sitting at the dining room table together at 6:30 to have dinner as a family. Rule number three, every Sunday is family day. You are not working on Sundays. And rule number four is every Thursday night is date night. And she just took personal responsibility, not only for her happiness, but the happiness of her entire family. And anybody who's looking at them today can honestly say that they're soulmates, that they have a really beautiful marriage together. But it's because Michelle took responsibility.
I think they are a good couple. They complement each other. I mean, she's a person in her own right as well. She's not like those other White House housewives that were just there to support their husbands. She has her own initiative. So, I mean, so we're here to take responsibility for our own happiness, but the other key to that equation is that we not can make someone else happy, but we're looking for the happiness of everyone involved. So it's not just my happiness. There's the other element there, right?
Yeah.
So
everybody wins. One thing I want to mention is, so my book, Turn Your Mate Into Your Soulmate, is coming out next Tuesday, which, by the way, happens to be my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
I'm super excited about that. Yeah, and I've got these amazing bonuses for anybody who wants to pre-order the book or buy the book. If you go to the website matetosoulmate.com, I have this 5-part video series with the world's top love experts, 2 free ebooks, and some audios on how to improve your sex life. So if you're at all interested in this topic, please, please, please go to matetosoulmate.com.
And they can order a 5-part video series.
Yeah, if you buy the book, you get all those goodies and bonuses.
Oh, if you buy the book online at that website, Mate to Soulmate?
Yeah.
Okay, you have to buy the book there.
Yeah.
And then you ship them the 5-part video series.
Oh, no, it's downloadable. They can get it instantly.
Oh, great. Are you going to be touring with this book anywhere?
I'll actually be in New York. I'll be speaking at the Open Center on January 12th. And then I'll be in Denver January 16th, 17th, and 18th at a bunch of different locations.
I'll look for you at the Open Center.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, this has been great. I know it's your passion, and you work really hard to be a clear channel of communication about relationships. And I it's like your life's work. You're really figuring it out for yourself and other people.
I first had to figure it out for myself. That's what happened. You know, I didn't know what I didn't know. So I'm super grateful that I was able to do that. I actually spent 130 hours interviewing the world's top love and relationship experts over the past years as part of this online series I do called The Art of Love. And then I road tested everything that I learned. So what's in this book is stuff that I can personally vouch for that I know that works.
Who did you really like out of the people you...
I love John Gray, who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. He's just a treasure. There's a woman named Allison Armstrong who has some incredible information that's just great. And, of course, I mentioned Dr. John Gottman and also Harville Hendricks. So there's just so many people that are serious PhD leading-edge researchers. And I was able to personally benefit from the work that they've done and come to really understand the dynamics of what big love is all about.
But is there something that's still hard in the relationship?
There are still days where, you know, we're going along and everything's fine, and then suddenly one of us says something and it gets misinterpreted or misconstrued, and, you know, but it doesn't last long anymore. You know, we're both very quick to apologize and to own our stuff, and, you know, because we realize we're on the same team. We care for each other. We want to be happy. And when stuff comes up, we talk it through. And we have different processes. I don't like confrontation. You know, if there's a confrontation, I want to get it over with as fast as possible. Brian likes to mull things over and revisit them for several days.
But what is it about... But what about being right? What about, you know, you're right in this argument. You're right. How do you get through both those people thinking they're right?
Well, you have to decide. Do you want to be right or do you want to have love? Sometimes you just got to shut your mouth. So, you know, they could have the facts wrong. They could be wrong about something. If it isn't a life-endangering situation, certainly don't correct them in public. Don't make them feel bad about it. Sometimes it's just best to put some imaginary masking tape over your mouth and just shut up.
No, this has been helpful. And like one last thing. So the soulmate thing, you're completing your life's issues, which is like kind of an accelerated course to be with the soulmate. And then what? What's like the next level of, let's say, incarnation, or let's say you really learn this human experience and communicate? What do you think? I'm sure, you know.
Well,
it's,
you know, I wrote a little book last year, which I actually give away for free. It's at loveontheotherside.com, and it's what happens when one half of a soulmate couple dies and goes to heaven, and the other one's still here on Earth, and how the love continues.
And how is that?
Well, the soulmate that's in heaven can actually help you find a new soulmate on Earth.
So the love never dies.
That's the big message.
Yes, and so you really feel, when someone dies, the love doesn't go anywhere. It actually gets stronger. So you don't believe in the twin flame thing?
I don't talk about the twin flame thing because it's a really complex situation. And quite often, twin flames don't incarnate on Earth at the same time. So that shouldn't stop you from having a soulmate love and experiencing great love and deep love. You know, so I think that the twin flame conversation is not applicable to most people.
All right. Well, all this really helps me. I'm reevaluating my, my need for the perfect person. And...
Well, I'll make sure you get a copy of the book, and then Brian and I will come dance at your wedding.
Okay, you promised that 5 years ago. I'm still waiting, but yes, we'll do that.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me on your show.
It's always fun to talk to you. I've been talking to Ariel Ford. Her latest book is Turn Your Mate Into Your Soulmate. Her website is www.soulmatesecret. That's one of them. Oh, and this other last one is matetosoulmate.com. That's the one. Order the book there. Get the free downloads. Thank you, Ariel. I'll see you in New York.
Okay. See you then. Thanks, Alan. Bye-bye.
Okay. Talk to you. Bye. It's Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. Thanks for listening. And if you have any questions, email me at newrealities@earthling.net. Thanks, and good night.